From the business desk at State Broadcast News, this is the CRE News Hour. I'm Steve Lubetkin. It's Friday, October 4th, 2019. In this episode of the CRE News Hour, we speak with William and Stephen King, founders of Imbrex, which is developing blockchain-based tools for commercial and residential real estate professionals. We have a conversation with Clark Mackamer, who's celebrating his first year leading Crow Holdings Industrial's Northeast operations after being recruited from Rockefeller Group. And Kathy Kraft of Nelson Worldwide shares insights into the urban shift changing the industrial real estate design market. We'll be back with the top CRE news stories right after these messages.
Turn your podcasting passion into profits. The book, The Business of Podcasting, describes the business side of podcasting, including how to become a professional podcaster. You'll learn about positioning your clients' expertise through podcasting, too, plus the best business models, how to find clients, and much more. Visit thebusinessofpodcasting.com.
Today, you can't wait for the media to cover your company. You have to be the media. Take advantage of the power of audio and video. It's the best way to showcase your expertise to prospective customers. Let the Lubetkin Media Companies handle the technical side. We're award-winning audio and video producers. We can help you produce podcasts and video programs remotely or in our fully equipped studio in Cherry Hill. Visit beingthemedia.com for more information. Thanks for joining us on the CRE News Hour. We'd just like to make note of a new option on the show page for this episode. You can click on the purple Take the Survey button right below the podcast player and share some information that will help us get to know our audience better. We'd also appreciate your considering financial support for the CRE News Hour by visiting our Patreon link and becoming a show supporter. You can also leave a tip in the tip jar by clicking the blue quid button right in the middle of the podcast episode page. And if you're interested in becoming a sponsor of the CRE News Hour, write to me at steve@statebroadcastnews.com and we'll send you the rate card for advertising and commercials. Now let's take a look at some of the stories that are moving CRE markets across the country. A lot of big deals and a lot of property portfolios changing hands this week. Colony Capital and Blackstone Real Estate Partners 9, an affiliate of Blackstone, announced they've entered into definitive agreements for Blackstone to acquire Colony Industrial, the industrial real estate assets and affiliated industrial operating platform of Colony, for an aggregate purchase price of $5.9 billion. The Colony Industrial Last Mile Light Industrial portfolio represents a substantial majority of the total transaction. It comprises about 60 million square feet of infill logistics assets across 465 light industrial buildings in 26 U.S. markets. The portfolio has significant concentrations in Dallas, Atlanta, Florida, northern New Jersey, and California. The transaction also includes Colony's 51% ownership interest in a 4 million square foot portfolio of bulk distribution assets and the affiliated operating platform, which manages the properties of both portfolios. The aggregate net sales proceeds to Colony are expected to be in excess of $1.2 billion. An investment group led by Ocean West Capital Partners, Tiger Alternative Investors, Korea Investments and Securities Company Limited, and Landmark Properties has closed the acquisition of two student housing portfolios worth about $250 million. The portfolios consist of five student housing communities with nearly 1,600 beds. The properties are located in three premier college markets, University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, University of Texas at Austin, and Florida State University in Tallahassee. Rubenstein Partners, a vertically integrated real estate investment advisor focused on value-added office property opportunities, and Monarch Alternative Capital LP, a global investment firm with opportunistic real estate expertise, have formed a joint venture purchasing the Lindbergh Center. That's a million-square-foot mixed-use property in Atlanta. The purchase price, $187 million. The popular Class A complex is built over Lindbergh Station, one of the busiest connections on Atlanta's MARTA rapid rail system. It's also adjacent to the MARTA headquarters building. Mack Real Estate Credit Strategies provided first mortgage financing for the transaction. The Lindbergh Center development is comprised of twin 14-story office buildings. It's located at Piedmont Road and Lindbergh Drive within Atlanta's thriving Buckhead submarket. The property is fully leased to AT&T until December 2020. It's also part of Lindbergh City Center, a 47-acre live-work-play development that includes numerous residential and retail offerings. Rubenstein and Monarch intend to implement a capital investment program to enhance the overall amenities at the property and recreate the neighborhood-friendly mixed-use environment at the heart of Atlanta's transportation network that the developers originally envisioned. Maryland-based developer Blue Ocean has announced its acquisition of the Middle River Depot. Located in eastern Baltimore County, Maryland, Middle River Depot is the largest industrial building in the state of Maryland and is an expansive and historically significant property. CBRE's Mid-Atlantic Institutional Group oversaw the sale of the 2-million-square-foot project to Blue Ocean. Institutional Property Advisors, a division of Marcus & Millichap, has announced the sale of Township Apartments, 132 units, in Redwood City, California. The sales price of $88.7 million works out to about $672,000 a unit or $735 a square foot. Unionized workers in New York are praising three recent court rulings that uphold the rights of immigrants. In three separate rulings last Friday, federal judges blocked the Trump administration's attempt to detain immigrant children indefinitely and issued a preliminary injunction against the fast-track deportation of immigrants anywhere in the country without due process. Another case permanently enjoined an ICE hub in California from requesting that local law enforcement detain immigrants based on a flawed database. Those rulings bring some security to members of SEIU Local 32BJ and their families. Union Vice President Shirley Aldebol says the majority of its members are immigrants with temporary protected status or green cards or are naturalized citizens.
They have been part of the fabric of this country for many years, and part of the culture of our union is that of a union of immigrant workers.
Claiming they bring crime and drain resources, the administration has stepped up efforts to deport undocumented people and prevent new immigrants from settling in the country. But immigrants who have lived in the United States for years, including veterans and many with U.S. citizen families, are being deported. To help fight those deportations, Aldebol points out that most 32BJ members have a legal services plan.
They are able to avail themselves of legal counsel to help them get citizenship, to bring their family members or renew their TPS or any legal assistance that they need.
She adds that the union recognizes that courts can only do so much to protect immigrants. Aldebol says 32BJ will keep working to ensure the rights of its membership and of all workers are protected and recognized.
We're going to continue to fight in the streets. We're going to continue to fight in the courts. We're going to continue to work with our allies for just reform of our immigration system.
You're listening to the CRE News Hour from statebroadcastnews.com. Crow Holdings is a privately owned real estate investment and development firm with a 70-year history. With the construction of a single warehouse in 1948, Trammell Crow established the foundation of an innovative and enduring enterprises. The company's making expansion moves in a number of markets across the country. In New Jersey, about a year ago, it recruited Clark Mackimer from the Rockefeller Group to lead Crow Holdings' industrial business in the Northeast. Clark oversees site selection and acquisition, team building, securing project entitlements, project design, construction, and project capitalization. At Rockefeller Group, Clark was responsible for sourcing and executing new developments in New Jersey and Pennsylvania. And throughout a 20-year career, he's been involved in leasing and development more than 13.5 million square feet of industrial space, 1 million square feet of office space, and 250 rental units. Clark began his career at Anderson Consulting. He's a past president of the New Jersey chapter of NAIOP and serves on the executive committee as past president. He's also a member of the board of trustees of CPNJ, and he's been recognized by NJ Biz Magazine as a member of its Real Estate Power 50 for the past 3 years. Clark, thanks for joining us on the CRE News Hour. What's going on with Crow Holdings? You guys are making a big expansion push in the Northeast. Tell us a little bit about what's going on.
Great. Well, thank you, Steve. Yeah, no, I'm really excited to be part of a great platform that Crow Holdings, and then specifically a lot of my focus is with Crow Holdings Industrial. Really excited to be working with them and partnering with them on our projects here in New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and New York. Really, the family history, it goes back to Trammell Crow, and you know, he started, you know, his business, which became one of the largest, if not the largest, real estate development companies in the world, with doing industrial buildings in the 1940s in Dallas, and grew that business through a lot of partnerships on an international basis, and had tremendous success. So today, Harlan Crow, who is Trammell's son, is our chairman. And he's leading our efforts across the entire real estate platform at Crow Holdings. And my focus is working with Ken Valick, our CEO of our equity development branch, which contains two brands right now, Trammell Crow Residential and Crow Holdings Industrial. Trammell Crow Residential has been around, you know, for many years. Ron Twilliger was a previous CEO, who many people know, and now leading that. But the Crow Holdings Industrial got going a little over 5 years ago, specifically when, you know, Harlan Crow was thinking about getting back into commercial development. And at that time, working with some folks within Crow Holdings, made the determination that industrial development was the best place to go and invest their dollars. And it's turned to be pretty fruitful given where the industrial world is today. So Harlan, working with one of our partners down in Dallas, Will Muttinger, started developing Dallas and grew that platform throughout Texas, got some projects in California, and then brought on a seasoned veteran, Phil Prassis, on the West Coast, who's been doing some tremendous stuff out there for the past 3 or 4 years. Matt Cruz in Chicago has been with Crow Holdings probably now about 2.5 years, and I joined about a year ago to start our operations here in the Northeast, and have a fairly substantial pipeline in short order. We have right now under control a pipeline of about 8 million square feet, you know, in Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and New York. So we're really excited, and we have shovels in the ground on our first project as we speak.
Can you talk a little bit about the first project?
I would like to, yeah. That's a project that is in Franklin Township. It's a site that's actually closest to Exit 9, which is New Brunswick. You know, so just about every exit on the New Jersey Turnpike has seen industrial development except for Exit 9. And a lot of that's just given the historic development patterns around Exit 9 have been centered in New Brunswick. So you have not had large available lands that you've seen further south in Exit 8A, Exit 8, and Exit 6, or what you may see along the now the 287 corridor, which a few years ago really wasn't seeing any development. But on that corridor, you've seen the redevelopment of a lot of old manufacturing facilities where you know have a few million square feet, you know, more than a few million square feet that's been developed. But Exit 9, there hasn't been large tracts of land. So we were successful in getting control of a former golf course, the Terra Greens Golf Course, and been working with Franklin Township for about a year to work through the entitlements on that. Actually acquired this site from a company called 2020 Acquisitions, who historically has done retail and residential and had looked to develop that on this site. But with the industrial market taking off, industrial became the highest and best use, and fortunate for us, the team over at 2020 Acquisitions thought we were the ideal developer to move it forward on an industrial basis. So we're in construction. pouring slabs as we speak. Alston Construction is our general contractor. And what I like about Alston is they don't let any grass grow under their feet. They go out, put their full team on a project and deliver buildings, you know, which could be 12 to 15 months. They're delivering buildings in 9 months, given the resources they're putting on.
And I gather there's a need for people to move quickly with all of the demand in the market.
The demand in the market, you know, everyone's looking at what's the future going to hold. Myself, along with, you know, my colleagues at Crow Holdings, believe that this industrial market is going to continue. But we want to capture the market that's here now, get a transaction done, and move on to the next. So we're going to be weather tight by the end of the year and able to have occupancy, you know, toward the end of first quarter, beginning of second quarter next year. And that's a building of just under 1 million square feet.
Is that and do you have people lined up for it yet, or is it spec built?
It's spec built, but given the nature, you know, a number of the brokerage firms have better than I am at quoting the stats, but I think it's over 80% of buildings that have been built in the last 5 years of over 750,000 square feet have been leased by the completion of construction. So that's our expectation. You know, we've underwrote something a little different, but given the market dynamics, we would think that we would be leased by the time we're complete with the building.
Now, location is everything, particularly in industrial real estate. And the Northeast has this location that's just, you know, the biggest consumer market, and everybody knows that. Are there any other factors that make the Northeast especially attractive besides the fact that it's where the people are?
Well, obviously, it's the people, it's the ports. And not only is it the people, the consumer base that you're delivering to, but also it's the labor force. That's becoming such a key component of companies. In making selections is the availability of labor. If you're out in central Pennsylvania and you're at a location that a large, you know, tenant comes in that has a lot of employees, that could suck up the employee base for that little submarket. You know, in the Northeast, when I say Northeast, you know, central, northern New Jersey, you know, southern Jersey, as you get close to Philadelphia, it's tremendous labor. And that's been a key as we've looked at identifying sites, is evaluating the labor. And what we did early on is we followed the rails, and not from a movement of goods perspective, but we looked at New Jersey Transit commuter lines and said, okay, what sites could be developed within close proximity to those rail lines? We're not going to be hugged up next to a commuter station because it's going to be residential or most likely, but you know, within a mile of that transit stop, could we find industrial locations? We've been able to do that. And I think that is something that's unique to industrial buildings in New Jersey is proximity and access to the transit lines.
And that's sort of a different viewpoint for industrial properties, because up until recently, it wasn't really necessary to have mass transit. There weren't that many people working in them.
Exactly. It's still the majority of the buildings may still have, you know, a few hundred employees if it's a million square footer. But, you know, as we all know, there's a, depending upon the operation within those facilities, you could have up north of 1,000 employees in some of those buildings filling orders for the e-commerce world. So, yeah, having that flexibility and the security to know, you know, you could draw from a larger labor pool if you're able to utilize the mass transit system of New Jersey, I think is a positive, and that's a positive for the site we're delivering in Franklin Township.
What do you see as the likely outlook for industrial property in the Northeast over the next couple of months, couple of years? Are things going to move okay, positive direction?
I think they are. You know, even if there's some larger economic force that impacts the economy. And maybe this is a, you know, rose-colored glasses or half-glass full view, but we're still at the infancy stage of what companies are doing and putting out their logistical supply chain. And if you pause right now, you're going to be passed by somebody. You know, so provided there's still capital available, companies are needing to get out ahead and stake their claim to a supply chain to function in today's e-commerce world. So I think the competitive nature of who our tenants are and our potential clients are is would continue to push forward the industrial market, even if there is a general slowdown in the overall economy. And then putting that aside, we believe at Kroll Holdings, there's a secular change in the marketplace today that even if there's a dip, you're still going to have a positive long-term view of industrial and logistics buildings.
I think one of the things you mentioned, the mass transit a little while ago, the infrastructure in the Northeast is challenged. The highways are challenged. The mass transit is challenged. Do you have any concerns about whether those problems are going to be addressed effectively and that's going to have an impact on your ability to both move goods in and out of these industrial properties and also to provide a workforce to them?
Yeah, no, I mean, we're always concerned about infrastructure. And that requires obviously the federal government, the state government to be, you know, making investments to further along the economy. But I think what we're seeing is, you know, companies are recognizing, you know, there are peak periods of time for traffic and they're planning accordingly. You know, when I was developing on the 287 corridor, you know, people said, well, you have traffic on 287. And I said, we do. We're not going to deny that fact. But if you're not on that corridor between 7 and 9 o'clock in the morning or 3:30 to 6 o'clock in the evening, that corridor is moving pretty well. And so I think companies are adjusting their delivery times, you know, from the port to the DC distribution centers to accommodate, you know, capacity in those roadway networks. You know, so there is some changes, but you know, the investment infrastructure remains the key item, you know, for the entire real estate community, not just, you know, the logistics and industrial world, but you know, be it office or retail or residential. You need to be investing. And I think you've seen within the state, you know, when they have made, you know, investments into infrastructure, economic development is followed right behind.
One of the other topics that's gotten a lot of interest, and particularly we heard a couple of weeks ago at the NAIOP ICON conference in Jersey City, and I don't know if you were there for the session on multi-story industrial. What's your take on multi-story? How challenging is it? Are you looking into doing it? Where do you think that's going to go?
Yeah, no, it's a very interesting topic. Obviously, for a conference like NAIOP ICON, something that's new and different is going to draw the attention of the attendees. So there was a lot of focus on that. You know, it's been talked about now for a few years. We and myself at Kroll Holdings, we're big believers in multi-story, but it's multi-story, you know, not outside of New York. New York has the density of the population where that multi-story is going to work. What we're spending a lot of time looking at is the design of these buildings. We have no doubt that there's demand for we'll call it rentable square footage, but then how do you design that rentable square footage? You know, what is the clear heights within each individual floor? Do you need to have loads, assuming it's going to be a 32-foot clear building with product racked from the floor to the ceiling, or would you be seeing lower, you know, lower load goods within that facility for higher turnover product? So, you know, the clear height may not be as critical as a facility located in, you know, central Pennsylvania, eastern PA, or central New Jersey. So that's a key piece. We believe in any multi-story building, the important driver is the number of doors, the outbound doors that you have. We're not as concerned about the inbound doors. You know, you'll be bringing in 53 footers off hour to load up that facility. But then, you know, come morning, you got to be able to get those goods and then those box trucks or fleet vehicles out of the facility to the consumers. And that becomes a big driver, is to make sure you have adequate doors to service that, you know, indoor floor space.
What about the economic situation, the trade war and the tariffs? Is that, are you seeing any pressure on construction projects because of the tariffs on inbound commodities that are used in the construction of industrial property?
Yeah, from the actual cost perspective, you know, any increases in construction, if you look at it over the last few years, there hasn't necessarily been a spike related to those tariffs, but I think, you know, just general construction increases, it has been reasonable. 10 years ago, back in 2005 and 6, the construction price increases you were seeing were double-digit percent increases year over year. We're not seeing that this time around. While a lot's being built, there's still a competitive marketplace out there of the subcontractor and contractor world. And also, I think there's a limitation on available land. You know, you're not seeing an overbuilding, and an overbuilding would lead to increasing construction cost. But from a tariff perspective, you know, yeah, there was a little jump in the construction pricing when the potential of tariffs first came out there. But you know, some of that pricing could have been, you know, there were suppliers that now saw an opportunity to raise their prices, which they're free to do. And they did that such that it wouldn't just be viewed as suppliers raising prices. They could always say part of the increase was due to incoming tariffs. On the tenant side, we've seen some tenants try to grab some space to accelerate the importing of goods into the country to beat some potential tariffs. So I think that has seen a positive impact on demand for industrial space.
Clark McAmer leads Crow Holdings Industrials business in the Northeast. Clark, we wish you luck with Crow Holdings, and thank you for joining us on the podcast.
Well, Steve, appreciate it. Always nice talking to you.
Listening to the CRE News Hour, I'm Steve Lubetkin. Blockchain technology, the digital encryption platform, is getting a lot of attention in all industries, including commercial real estate. There are a number of companies using blockchain to create new opportunities and new applications. With us on the program is Stephen King and his brother William King, who are the founders of Imbrex. It's a company that is developing a blockchain application that presents what they call an unbiased forum for MLSs and firms to exchange data and overcome the trust gap between transacting organizations. Imbrex says it offers efficiencies in terms of syndication and real-time updates that ensure consumers have access to accurate property information with no geographic restrictions. William and Stephen, thanks for joining us on the CRE News Hour. We know sort of what blockchain technology is. I wonder if you could tell us how you at Imbrex are applying this to creating an independent marketplace for CRE transactions.
Hey, Steve. This is Stephen King here. And sure, yeah, so I'll take that one. So William and I were brothers. We come from a real estate family. Our dad is an architect, engineer, turned real estate developer. And so we've been around the business our entire lives. I found myself in the commercial brokerage world, and we were using about eight or nine different applications to go from the marketing process of a property all the way to closing. And all these different applications, they had no way to communicate with each other. So for us as a firm owner, it was really difficult to track where each agent was in the transaction and then do things like make financial projections. And as William and I dug into the technology, we found that the one industry, real estate, where in the physical world, you know, when you're going to do something like a mixed use development, you go out, you set up the infrastructure, you bring in the utility lines, the water, and then you start digging foundations and framing walls. Well, in the digital world, they basically found a plot of field and everybody started digging their foundations and putting up their walls without hooking up any of the utilities. And so, we came across this technology called the blockchain, and the blockchain provides that unification or that communication channel between all these disparate applications. So now we can take something like a listing or a purchase and sale agreement, and we can accurately track it, and we can append it to the property so that we can see an accurate historical record of the property. And not only that, but move it between different applications that we may be currently using or applications that may be developed in what we call Web 3, which is basically this new evolution of the internet, which includes blockchain and some other technologies.
So what makes the blockchain technology different and more reliable or more what? That it's the way to go in your mind for creating these kinds of transactions?
Steve, this is William here. I'll take that one. The thing that's great about the blockchain is, you know, all of the capabilities that Stephen had described in terms of opportunities to unify and have single source of the truth and append attributes to entities, in this case to physical real estate property. But the wonderful thing about it as well really is the security and the compliance and the auditability. And specifically, obviously, as the name implies, with blockchain, what happens is when data is encrypted, first of all, the encryption schema is extraordinarily secure, and it's incredibly expensive to hack. I think that the statistics are several million dollars a minute to try and hack the system. So it economically, obviously, wouldn't make sense for somebody to try and hack at the system. But what the system enables, what the blockchain technology really enables people to do is take a piece of data, encrypt it in a very secure form, and then store that on a ledger. And over time, these encryption strings form together to form blocks, and ultimately those blocks form together to form the chain of blocks. And the thing that is very powerful about that is that if anyone tries to go back and change a record or change an activity, try and remove, for example, if I send you $10 and that's now been logged and that's in the system and that's a piece of the blockchain, I try and go back and change those records, the whole chain falls apart. You can't do it. So we have very clear transparency and appropriate transparency, and we can talk about what that means. It doesn't mean that anybody can see every single thing that's going on. There certainly is the ability to obfuscate some of the details when appropriate. But fundamentally, the actions that are taking place, they not only benefit from this encryption schema, which is really second to none, but importantly, they're immutable. So we can always go back in time and we can see what's occurred, and there is that, in fact, single source of the truth.
Now, for the independent agent who has maybe tied their fortunes to a brokerage name, you know, as an independent contractor operating under a particular brand umbrella, how does this disrupt that relationship? And what kind of feedback are you hearing from for the independent broker side and also from the companies that want to recruit those agents?
This is William again, Steve. Oh, go ahead, Steve.
No, I was just going to say it'd probably be useful to talk about the interview that we just had with the San Francisco commercial agent a couple of days ago. So, William, please take it away.
Yeah, great minds think alike. I had the same thought. Look, at the end of the day, the technology is tremendous, and both Stephen and myself are very passionate about blockchain, and we're very excited about all the things that are coming in Web3. But what's more important is really solving practical problems for people. And while the technology can be very alluring and is fun to discuss and is certainly fun to build and work with, what we really endeavor to do are solve practical problems. And so the question that you posed really, I guess the way that I'll reframe it is, where is there friction today in the relationship? And where is there friction just in the day-to-day when it comes to people's jobs? And I think that one of the key things that we get feedback about is really within this relationship between the brokerage house and the agent or the broker themselves, compliance and security are very important components. Obviously, you know, these large firms have lots of different people, lots of different agents, representatives that are doing lots of different deals. And so ensuring that the deals are being done in a compliant way, ensuring that they're being done legally, of course, and according to the customary, not just laws, but just the norms of how different markets operate, that's a critical piece of that relationship, making sure that the individual can not only act in all of the right ways, but then can report that back to the big brokerage house. So one of the first benefits that we see is the ability to streamline the transparency to and from the brokerage house to the agents or the brokers themselves. And so that's an enormous benefit. But the second benefit really is about sort of people's day jobs, if you will, and specifically where they spend time and how can they be more efficient with that time spent. And for the large brokerage houses, as Stephen had mentioned, when you have lots of different systems and you have lots of different agents, trying to track a deal, just a single deal can be a challenge. But when you start to scale that up across hundreds and thousands, sometimes 10,000s of agents across many different geographies, it becomes an administrative exercise, to say the least. So what we're able to do with this technology and these solutions is be very transparent with what's going on with each agent, with each deal, and then roll that up to a dashboard that can be viewed by the brokerage house. So it's very easy for, if you're a CFO of a large brokerage house and it's the 25th of the month and you know it's time to start to bring the numbers together and report on you know what happened in that month, rather than have to make phone calls and emails and inquiries individual by individual, which is actually quite common today, you have the ability to get full transparency into all of the deals, see where they are stage-wise, and be much more refined and predictable when it comes to the forecasting. The benefit to the agent themselves is, of course, very similar in that they themselves, even at one transaction, they can see all the different constituents from the buy and sell side to all the support, the ancillary people that are involved, and you know whether they're inspectors and other folks that are constituents in the transaction. They can see exactly what's happening, what the tasks are for that various constituent, what's been completed and potentially what's not been completed and may need some TLC in terms of advancing it to the next step. So really, I guess in sum, what we're endeavoring to do is, as I said from the outset, number one, be very focused on where the real world problems and opportunities for improvement are. And number two, to make that relationship between the brokerage house and the brokers and agents themselves a lot stronger, and do so without a lot of additional activity, reporting, you know, data entry, things like that, but do so with a system that that solves the day-to-day problems and also enhances a lot of the core components of what makes the relationship successful in the first place.
Yeah, and Steve, just to add to that a bit, we have one commercial agent out in California, and he acts as a dual agent for both the landlord and the tenant rep in most of his deals. And so he's got a lot of different activity going on that he has to keep track of. And because he represents both sides, you know, he has concerns about, you know, he's never been sued, but he wants to document everything accurately so that in case he's ever sued, he's got an audit trail of everything that happened over time. And not just that, he's got so many deals going at once that being able to log in and clearly identify, hey, here's the next action item, or hey, this purchase and sale agreement or this lease has been with the landlord's attorney for a week and a half. Well, it's got clearer action items that he can pick up the phone and call and facilitate the deal forward. And the other thing too, he said, look, if I want to go down and surf in Cabo for a week and I want to just plug somebody else into the deal with this app, I can do that. I can grab one of my buddies or an assistant and plug them right in. And then I can just track everything that's going on throughout this deal. And I can leverage the smart contracts that you guys employed so that we can actually do things like payments or tenant improvement allowances. So rather than wait for a month and a half to receive a check from the landlord, you know, a tenant I represent, well, you can program these contracts so that if they're supposed to release, you know, if the landlord's supposed to give them $500,000 in TI over a 5-month period at the first of the month, well, you can put the money into the contract and you can deploy it automatically at the first of the month. So now he's got both an audit trail and he's got assurances that these payments are going to be on time.
How does this process compare to the way people have been working up to now? Does this significantly streamline the work for them, or does it add another layer to something that they might already be doing?
No, it streamlines it.
Yeah, that's all I was going to say. For the agent, it streamlines it and compiles it all into one place. And for the enterprise, what it does is a lot of the commercial firms like JLL and Colliers, they're all building their own internal transaction products, which is great. It's actually, we love that because when people look at what we're doing, they ask, is that a problem or are they competitors? And they're not at all. What's happening is they're building internal transaction products that benefit their organizations and benefit their agents. And what we're able to add is that interoperability piece, that connection piece that gives them a feed to the external world. So maybe to a system that the landlord's working with or the title company. And really what we're able to do is the application that you see, we actually call it Escrow Commons. It's really just a viewer. So if you look at, you know, CoStar or LoopNet today, the application, behind the application, there's a bunch of information that's stored on CoStar and LoopNet servers. And that information is generated from the brokerage house and the individual agents. Well, with us, it's actually not stored on our servers. So the agents and the brokerages are in control of all the documents, all the listing information. And we just provide the viewer, sort of like if you're in New York City on Broadway at 10 o'clock at night, you can view into a retail store and see all the mannequins and the merchandise. But as soon as 11 p.m. hits, all the lights go off and you can no longer see through the store. It's sort of like that if that data doesn't exist behind those lights go out, that data is not with us, it's with the individuals.
So what's next in the process of rolling this out? Are you gaining traction with the brokers? And if so, you know, what are your next steps to get others to embrace the technology for you?
Steve, this is William here. Thanks for that question. The thing that's most important here is that the streamlining is making people more efficient in their jobs. And what we've found is, just as Stephen had said, you know, you have all of these different systems. I mean, take something like commission payouts. The number of different pieces that are involved in, you know, first of all, the transaction going through, getting, you know, money's wired to escrow or to a closing company. Maybe a check gets sent to the brokerage house. Those checks need to then be split. The commission payments need to get paid out. All of these different components now can be streamlined into one application. So our focus now really for next steps is to continue to work with the constituents, the primary constituents that we've identified for this first phase. Those are the brokers, the agents, the brokerage houses, and the developers. And we do so it's important to note on the commercial and the residential side. So we're continuing to advance with those partners. We're continuing to roll out, as Stephen had described, Escrow Commons and really demonstrate the streamlined and the efficient aspects of the offering. But what's really exciting for us is as we continue to grow and we continue to get feedback is that the other constituents that are part of the transaction have really expressed a very keen interest in not just participation, but also in ownership and or even sort of starting the process, starting the closing room of Escrow Commons. And those are folks like title companies, they're attorneys, they're people that are part and parcel to how real estate transactions are done today, but they suffer the same fragmentation that we've been describing for the agents and the brokers. And so an important aspect of our continued evolution is to service these constituents in the market and to continue in the same way that we've worked with the brokers and the brokerage houses and the developers to continue to onboard those folks that are outside of our initial rollout focus and to ensure that configuration and all of the offerings are intuitive and logical in the ways that they would expect. But even beyond that, what we're additionally excited about is the ability now to move the data between the different constituents. And this is truly a real estate network, and it's truly a global real estate network. And what Stephen had described before, when the listing data goes to LoopNet, CoStar, or MLS, that is obviously what ends up happening, of course, is that becomes a single server, that becomes a single node that the data is sent to. It's not only from a security standpoint, there are all kinds of vulnerabilities, potential vulnerabilities that exist. From an economic standpoint, it's quite expensive. And so what we've been able to demonstrate with this encryption component of the blockchain is, as Stephen had described with the example in Times Square, you now have the ability to own your data and you have the ability to ship it to whatever constituents are relevant. And if at any point in time that sort of spigot needs to be turned off and that data needs to be pulled back, you don't suffer from having it entirely on one server. You have the ability yourself to move it. And so what we're really excited about as we continue to grow the company is not just to help in all the meaningful ways that we have around the transaction and really remove a tremendous amount of friction in that process, but to also begin to enable the data flows, the real estate listings, much more easily between the different constituents and between the different markets. And so we're excited about what that will look like in the future, this prospect that, you know, in the way that today I can search for clothing online, I could look at a manufacturer of clothing in Japan or China or the UK or Italy as easily as I can in the United States. Of course, it's not that easy when it comes to real estate. If I want to look at property data, I mean, frankly, even within the United States, if I want to look at, you know, commercial property data alongside of residential, there's no easy and clear place for me to do that unless I'm willing to pay a pretty hefty sum. And so obviously now with this blockchain and this encryption and all the offerings that we have here at Embrex, the fact that these people that are the originators of the data can own the data gives them the ability to move the data very meaningfully. And so we're very excited about that future state, not just as I described for the additional constituents of the transaction, but fundamentally for the listings themselves and the ability for more people who are relevant and qualified potential buyers or lessees to be able to view and engage much more easily.
Well, it sounds like a transformational approach to getting the data into people's hands, and we wish you luck with it. And thank you for being with us on the podcast today.
It's been our pleasure, Steve.
Thanks, Steve.
William and Stephen King are the founders of Embrex Corporation, which is developing blockchain applications for commercial and residential real estate. We'll be back in a minute.
Shalom. This is Rabbi Richard Address. Join us for our podcast series from Jewish Sacred Aging entitled Seekers of Meaning. We'll explore some of the issues and events that impact ourselves, our families, and our Jewish world at large in light of the current revolution in aging.
The Seekers of Meaning podcast airs every Friday morning at 8 a.m. at JewishSacredAging.com. Can't wait for the media to cover your company. You have to be the media. Take advantage of the power of audio and video. It's the best way to showcase your expertise to prospective customers. Let the Lubetkin Media Companies handle the technical side. We're award-winning audio and video producers. We can help you produce podcasts and video programs remotely or in our fully equipped studio in Cherry Hill. Visit beingthemedia.com for more information. Nelson Worldwide is a global architecture and design firm in Minneapolis, and it has some insights for the industrial market, where it's seeing a broad shift from previous generations. Joining us to talk about the changes in industrial design is Kathy Kraft. Kathy has a 30-year history of award-winning design, and she leads Nelson's industrial practice. Kathy, thanks for joining us on the podcast. Tell us a little bit about the changes you're seeing in the industrial market compared to what people were doing in terms of design in previous generations.
Some of the biggest changes, I would say, are the first that tenants are wanting more office, and the office is more industrial looking, not traditional vanilla office. And oftentimes it's integrated in with their operations in the warehouse or assembly or R&D facilities. We are seeing a lot more R&D, particularly in the Seattle market. We're also seeing some light manufacturing, corporate type of operations, startup companies. We just completed a vertical vegetable growing operation. There's also a lot more of the craft level operations of smaller breweries and distilleries that want showroom, tasting room, along with their production and distribution.
There's been an enormous demand for industrial space, particularly in the big consumer markets like New York, New Jersey, on the West Coast. And a lot of it's being driven by e-commerce and people who want to get their the products to the consumer as quickly as possible. But there's also been changes in the kinds of warehouse space and expectations because there are more people working in these warehouses. Talk a little bit about how that impacts the design changes that you're seeing.
Well, we've definitely seen a lot more last mile and last touch delivery in the urban markets and just on the fringe of the downtown core. Some of the requirements for those type of tenants are a lot more parking because there are a lot more employees in the building, as well as circulation for queuing and stacking of vehicles. The delivery methods are changing, so you might not have as many large 53-footers. But then the outbound to the last mile delivery are a lot of, whether they're Sprinter vans or box vans, independent drivers. We're definitely seeing a lot more traffic and high volume.
One of the things we're also seeing in the retail sector is that retail stores have less and less inventory actually in the store. We hear anecdotally that people go to the stores and it's not in stock, whatever the product is they want to buy. And they're told, you know, order it online and they can ship it to the store and you can pick it up here. So how is that a change for the way warehouse properties are being used?
I think that's also, it's grocery store properties, existing retail, as well as industrial properties. I think you're going to see a lot less retail space. It doesn't make sense financially to pay somebody to unload a box and then put it on the shelf, and then they're paying shoppers to go pick up all of the stuff for last mile, you know, home delivery. So I think that you're going to see a little retail up front, more warehouse in the back for pick and pack, and other, whether it's delivery drivers are taking things there or the consumer wants to stop and pick it up, kind of like some chain restaurants have that 10-minute parking where you can stop and pick up your order to go. You're going to see that, I think, more in the grocery store world as well. I think it's becoming more mixed use in both the industrial and on the retail.
You talked earlier about the building up, the vertical rise of industrial buildings is getting taller. You talked about vertical farming, which I know is coming into some of the older industrial properties. What are the other challenges that you're seeing in terms of building up rather than spreading out a warehouse facility?
Well, one of the, I think the shocking thing for everybody is how expensive it is for the building construction itself. Once you get over two stories, you've got fire rating, and once you get over 65 feet, you're into high-rise construction, which is even more expensive and has additional requirements, as well as just getting the product vertically down to the ground level to the vehicles. Takes more space for ramps. We've got a 5-story in Queens that only the first two levels are accessed by ramps, and then the other higher stories are smaller products using freight elevators. It's definitely more costly, and I think the Prologis project that we completed in Georgetown here in Seattle was a great way to get in as the first vertical warehouse in the country, but now the sellers of land in the area are also looking at that from a pricing standpoint. So they've raised their prices because now they're saying, well, you could go vertical on my site, and so the coverage is a lot better. So real estate's trying to catch up on the pricing.
Mm-hmm. When you're dealing with a client that wants you to help them with a new industrial property, what are the things that you try to learn from them about what their needs are, and how does that shape the kinds of design ideas you feed back to them?
Oh, that's a good question. We love to get feedback and input from their brokers as far as what kind of users they're seeing in that particular market, and what kind of RFPs are out there on the street, and sizes and types of uses, so we can adjust our layouts to accommodate the kind of the majority of the users that are out in demand at that time. And then also thinking of in the future, how things, you know, what trends are changing, the demand for industrial sites, and make adjustments that way.
How much of your business is spec build for clients who pretty much know that they're going to lease it before they have a shovel in the ground? And how much of it is built to suit for people who have very specific needs, for example, cooler space for refrigerated warehousing? What's the breakdown, and how do you approach them differently?
I would say probably 80% of our business right now is speculative developer on the industrial side. And it, at least in this market, the Atlanta market is a little different. It's higher build-to-suit than speculative. But I would say that the build-to-suit demand is more in the food service, cooler freezer, food processing, and the aerospace industry. Otherwise, we're doing a lot of speculative, trying to envision which kind of tenants would be coming to that market.
Is that a bit easier to design because you kind of have several designs that fit all? Or are there some challenges in tweaking and customizing spec build as well?
There are challenges on the spec side because you're trying to work with brokers and with the developer and what their goals are and what they think the future is going to hold, and making sure that it's flexible, as well as what the trends are moving forward. We've got still, we went from 32 to 36 foot clear. Now we're seeing 40 foot clear, and making sure that at the end of the day, when the building is finished, that it is meeting current demand.
Are you getting any sense of any kind of change in demand for industrial facilities? Is it is growth continuing to climb? Is it staying the same? Or are we starting to see any kind of stability in the market where maybe there's not as much demand for new space as there had been in the past couple of years?
We haven't seen a slowdown, which is a good thing for us. We have definitely seen the demand change. I would say that everybody's wanting more parking and better circulation. I think a lot of it has to do with the change in the last mile delivery and their methods. And if they're using independent drivers, which I think is an ideal way to keep costs down. There's just a lot more circulation required on site, as well as, and then if they own their own vans or box vans, that they've got to store those someplace. So we're definitely seeing a higher ratio of parking.
Kathy Kraft leads the industrial practice at Nelson Worldwide, a global architecture and design firm in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Kathy, thanks very much for taking the time to chat with us today.
Oh, you're welcome. My pleasure.
And that'll do it for this week's edition of the CRE NewsHour. Don't forget to check out our audience survey by clicking on the purple Take the Survey button below the podcast player on the show page for this episode. And please consider becoming a financial supporter of our podcast by clicking the Patreon button. If you have comments about our program or a story idea that you'd like to see us cover, send me an email. The address is steve@statebroadcastnews.com. You can also leave us an audio comment by using the voicemail feature on the right sidebar of our website at statebroadcastnews.com. We produce this show in the State Broadcast News studios in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. Some audio in this program was provided by our content partner, publicnewsservice.org. For everyone at the CRE News Hour and State Broadcast News, this is Steve Lubetkin. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you out there on the net. Take good care.